my presence here is a bit of a surprise because I wasn't planning on it, but I look at it as a great pleasure. I'm a New Yorker by birth, but I've been overseas on every continent of the world for the past 35 years. So, although I am from New York City, I've been gone for so long. Currently, I'm based in Australia, New Zealand. But from there, I travel on every continent. It's hard work, all that traveling, but you get a lot of perspectives. I thought your topic tonight was quite interesting. Science as faith and scientific faith. I don't know if you all can see this quotation on the board from Pasteur. It says a lot if you think about it. He's letting you know that there could be a lot going on that's beyond the normal range of our studies and our perception. We're going to be talking about yoga tonight. Yoga in terms of our studies and yoga in terms of a different way of getting knowledge, a different way of understanding. I'd like to first present to you the possibility that in your studies, you're going through something called the yoga of objectivity. This is a term coined by a philosopher at the University of Michigan, Henry Skolimowski. What is this yoga of objectivity? If you're going to understand something, you have to just separate yourself out from it. And you undergo rigorous academic training, beginning as a young child, how to analyze the world in a quantifiable way. It doesn't matter what your consciousness is, because after all, who knows really what consciousness is? Just study the facts, study the world as if it exists separate from you. When people think of yoga, they generally picture persons going through a rigorous set of physical exercises repeated every day, stretching the muscles, toning the body, day after day, year after year. Just think of our academic studies beginning in grade school. Think of it as a yoga system for honing the mind to see a certain way and to think a certain way. Certainly, that kind of yoga, the yoga of so-called objectivity, has its value. And what we know as science specializes in this yoga of so-called objectivity. Just study the world as if it exists separate from your consciousness. You have to do that because there is no reliable scientific understanding of consciousness. In order to understand consciousness, you'll have to adopt non-traditional methods. But we'll get to that later. Let's just continue to talk about the yoga of objectivity. That I'm going to study something, I'm going to master a subject, I'll be tested, I'll focus on pure clinical information. We go through this since childhood. But what we rarely perceive is that we're taking on a lot of hidden cultural assumptions. And our mind is being operated upon in a very, well, you might say, sinister way. So what happens as a result of this enforced yoga of objectivity is that you have very focused knowledge of a limited range of human experience. Things that don't fit into that range are deemed as paranormal or unscientific. Yes, science as we know it has brought about a lot of conveniences. There's no doubt about that. At the same time, there are huge gaps in knowledge. There are immense areas of the human experience that science cannot give us definitive knowledge about. Let's just take, for example, your own consciousness. Consciousness, what allows us to be aware, is a mystery to science. Roughly speaking, you'll find three groups. Scientists who say, we're sure consciousness is matter. It emerges from the properties and organization of the brain. We're sure that there are neurons that are completely responsible for consciousness. There's no proof for this whatsoever. This is faith, absolute faith. Then you have a second group of scientists who say, we'll never understand what consciousness is because it's beyond the whole scientific methodology. It's beyond the yoga that we're doing. Knowledge of consciousness is beyond the yoga of objectivity. Then a third group of scientists will say, we just don't know. So this is the state of the art in terms of consciousness studies. Naturally, if we don't understand our consciousness, how do we truly understand what we are aware of? Because all our awareness comes to us through the medium or by the grace of our consciousness. Now, it so happens that whenever you bring up this possible existence of consciousness as a non-material reality, someone may laugh at you. How unclinical, how unobjective. You're getting very murky. You're talking about the ghost in the machine. The scientific view is that you're a physical entity subject to the physical laws of nature. Although that can't be proved right now, there's no doubt in the future it will be proved. As Stephen Hawking said, let's just face it. We're all just chemical scum on a moderate-sized planet. That's all there is to it. So you have to decide for yourself how you feel about that. Why get hung up about your identity, enlightenment, self-realization? You're just chemical scum. Face it and go on with life. If you're just matter, then why should anything matter? We can take some dirty dishwater, pour it down the drain. Does anyone object? But if we take you and try to stuff you down the drain, what happens? You don't go for it. No one goes for it. So what is it about you as matter, just chemical scum on a moderate-sized planet? What is it about you that matters so much if you're just matter? Most people feel quite uncomfortable when facing this reductionist, materialistic paradigm. They feel edgy, but, well, anyway, there must be something spiritual about me. Somehow or other we can't explain it. If you look at scientists themselves, according to latest polls, 40% of scientists accept they believe that there is some ultimate personal being. Not in some kind of vague, amorphous sense, but they feel that there is an ultimate personal being whom they can talk to and be reciprocated with. 40%. That figure, from a poll taken a few years ago, is the same as it was at the beginning of the 20th century. But let's be skeptical. If you want to quibble about it, and some persons do, when you go to the National Academy of Science, where arguably the leading scientists are members, the percentage drops down to 10%. Whether 40% or 10%, it's obvious that you cannot discard the possibility of a non-material reality. Even leading scientists don't unanimously do that. What I think causes the confusion is that science as we ordinarily know it and spiritual systems address different aspects of reality. They're both good at what they do. So if we can clarify what is the proper domain of each quest for knowledge, then we can not get into any commotion about, well, you're just a true believer, or you're just a materialistic scientist. They're two different ways of looking at the world, and they have different successes. If you look at Bhagavad Gita, the essential classic yoga text from ancient India, I remember during my senior year at Yale, I wanted to study Eastern knowledge. So I did a very brave and courageous thing. I decided I would enroll in a class about Eastern philosophy, even though the class met at the ungodly hour of 8 a.m. With great, and just great determination and willpower, I climbed out of bed at 7:15, threw on my clothes, and staggered to class. Normally my principle was never take a class before 11:30. No matter what the subject was, just look at the class time. 8 o'clock, forget it. Nothing is that good. We were allowed to pick our courses from across a wide range of academic disciplines. And things weren't so intensely competitive as they are now, in which you have to consider every course you take has an impact on your future. Be very careful. Wasn't like that so much then. At that time, according to polls, 70% of all university students had as their number one goal in life to find what is meaning, what is the self. And financial concerns were far down the list. Up until very, very recently, that has been reversed. The number one goal of university students has been to make money, and in far down the list is to find the meaning of life. It's suddenly starting to change with the freshman class of this year, according to UCLA, which keeps track of all this stuff, the attitudes of each freshman class in successive years. According to this UCLA study, for the first time since the early 70s, when I was a university student, for the first time, university freshmen say their number one goal in life is to do something about the problems in the world. So this is extraordinarily significant. Very, very significant. This is like a polar shift. So, I indeed made it to the 8 o'clock class, and world-famous professor, he's still world-famous, he gave the first assignment. He talked about the overview of what we're going to be studying, and he gave the first assignment. All right, I want you to read a section of the Upanishads, another yoga text from ancient India. Read a section and write down what you think it means. So I said to myself, wait a minute. I've gotten up at the ungodly hour of 7:15. I've staggered out into the New Haven cold to come to a class just to be told to read something and write what I think. Well, I don't need to get up this early in the morning just to speculate. I could do that on my own. So forget this course. I'm going to the university bookshop. I'll check out all the required reading and recommended reading for this course. I'll do it on my own. So I did that. And so Bhagavad Gita was on the list. As well as another text called Yoga, Immortality, and Freedom. I said, well, that sounds cool. Yoga, Immortality, and Freedom. Yes, let's go for it. So I took the Bhagavad Gita home. It was a version by a British scholar named Edgerton. Now, you got to understand the times then in order to appreciate what I'll say. Back then, if you were a genuine student, you had to be against something. You had to be always on the lookout for imperialism, exploitation, colonization, this, that, the other, and ready to protest. That was the mindset. So I just flipped through the book, and the scholar had the verses of Bhagavad Gita in the front and commentary, his own commentary in the back. So I just looked at his commentary and I saw this sentence. Krishna is a concept meant to appeal to both the intellectuals and the sentimentalists. I just reacted quite vehemently. Who is this imperialist British colonizer commenting on the people of India's book? What does he know? So I just took the book, threw it against the wall. That was that. A few months later, I did, after graduation, I came across an authentic Bhagavad Gita, and that was when I underwent some lifestyle and hopefully consciousness changes. So, you might ask, what's so special about this Krishna knowledge, the yoga texts, which present the yoga ladder from beginning with physical exercises, going on up to breathing exercises, and then with a focused mind encountering the supreme conscious cause of all causes? How does this yoga system fit in with the quest for knowledge? Is it just about faith? Just look at the word yoga in of itself. Yoga means to link, to connect. The yogi understands the interconnectedness of life. He or she doesn't try to separate himself or herself from the total reality and think, okay, I'm going to get an objective vision of everything, devoid of subjectivity. Please think about it. How can you escape subjectivity? Subjectivity means you, the person. And a scientist, an honest scientist, has to agree. I don't know what subjectivity is because I don't know what consciousness is. As long as I don't know what consciousness is, I don't know the very mechanism or the very medium that allows me to be aware. So here you are, just as I was at the university, you're studying so many things with a something or the other that's unknown. So you'll say, well, I know this is a blackboard, these are walls, ceiling, these are persons, but all these percepts are coming to me by the grace of something that we don't know about. So an unknown is trying to have something known. The yogis understand this trap and they stay away from it. The yogis understand. First, understand what you are. Understand what is consciousness. And then transform that consciousness so that you'll be aware of things that are beyond the purview of normal science. So once again, when we talk about ancient yogic knowledge and we talk about science as is known, both are systems for knowing. But the question is, knowing what? You won't turn to the yoga texts for knowledge about technology as people know of technology today. How to do some engineering task. But what you will find in the yoga texts is information about how to shape external events with your consciousness. The popular rendition of mind over matter. Spoon benders can bend a spoon with their mind. Uri Geller, remember his famous statement, don't use the good silver. Contemporary science, as it's known now, has no explanation for this. But they can't disprove it. But there's nothing in the scientific realm now to explain why someone can bend a spoon with their mind. Because what is the mind anyway? What is consciousness? What is awareness? This is not known. There's not one scientific instrument in the world that can directly detect the presence of consciousness. The only way that you think others are conscious is because you're conscious, so you assume, well, you seem to act like me, so you must be conscious too. But there's no scientific instrument in the world that can directly detect the presence of consciousness. Why should matter become conscious? How does matter become conscious? Think about it. It's like saying, this watch produces time. Out of this watch comes time. No, you say, the watch is a very nice device for indicating the passing of time. It's not that the watch produces time. You wouldn't say, biscuits produce numbers. Rhubarb produces ethics. The brain produces consciousness. Oh, wait. That could be possible. How is it possible? Show in scientific terms, as you know it, show the process how the brain produces consciousness. There's no such reality. There's just a hope. And to be fair, only a minority of scientists will take the hard line and say, consciousness is matter, the brain produces consciousness, there's no doubt, even though we can't prove it, there's no doubt. It's a minority. As I said, the others will say, we don't know, maybe we'll know, we don't know now, or we'll never know. Okay, so, if you want to understand things beyond the conventional knowledge, you have to adopt knowledge acquiring methods that are unconventional. Unconventional according to the particular culture you're in. We've been in a culture which emphasizes the yoga of objectivity. Cold clinical analysis, the hard data. Do you say data or data in America? Which one?
Data.
Data, okay. So, keep yourself out of it. Subjectivity is a taboo. It doesn't matter what your personal behavior is. That has nothing to do with your ability to study something. Well, when you turn to the yoga of subjectivity, we can call Krishna consciousness the yoga of subjectivity. It takes your personal subjectivity as the foremost reality, doesn't hide from it, and it says, how can your personal subjectivity be transformed so you can genuinely experience things that are considered beyond the range of the senses? It's not about faith, it's about transformation. Sensory enhancing. All right, we'll go back to the example of spoon bending with the mind. There's nothing spiritual about spoon bending. As Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita, mind is subtle matter. So a yogi or a psychic can bend a spoon with the mind. It's not mind over matter, it's subtle matter over gross matter. Now, there's nothing in science to explain why Uri Geller should be able to bend a spoon with his mind. Although there's nothing in science to explain that, he's hired by oil companies throughout the world to use his psychic powers to find oil. So when it comes to money, when it comes to oil, things can be a bit flexible. Well, whether it's scientific or not, who cares? Just get out there and find the oil. We're presenting to you the yoga of subjectivity. You might be interested to know that nowhere in Bhagavad Gita, which is the classic yoga text, pointing at bhakti yoga, connection with the Supreme Consciousness as the ultimate goal of life, nowhere in Bhagavad Gita does Krishna say, believe in me. You will never find a verse in Bhagavad Gita where Krishna says like that. Not that belief in Supreme Consciousness, not that there's anything wrong with that. We're not here to decry religious belief. But in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna wants to give you tools of experience. For example, in the beginning of the seventh chapter, Krishna speaks to his student Arjuna, I am now going to explain to you how you can attach your mind to the Supreme Consciousness. You'll know the Supreme Consciousness, you'll know me in full, and there won't be any doubts. Just listen, I'll teach you the laboratory experience, how you're going to do that, the techniques, how you're going to do that. So you won't find anywhere in Bhagavad Gita where Krishna talks about your believing. Although, there's nothing wrong with a spiritual belief, but generally most people want to push on beyond belief. They want laboratory experience. And that's what the techniques of Krishna consciousness do. For example, if I stood before you and said, I believe this is New York City. You just yawn. So what? You might look at the attitude of Bhagavad Gita in that way as a reason why Krishna doesn't say, believe there's a Supreme Consciousness. It's just considered ho-hum. But the techniques to verify your spiritual consciousness and the Supreme Spiritual Consciousness, that is the special thing. So now we're heading from the yoga of objectivity, which actually is packed with hidden assumptions and cultural biases, to the yoga of subjectivity, in which the practitioner is not afraid to identify with what he or she is studying, to enter into the world of what he or she is studying. This is starting now in academic circles to be considered a legitimate way of acquiring knowledge. I'll give you an example. We're speaking about the partnership between the researcher and the phenomenon that the researcher is studying. One biologist, Elizabeth Sartoris, she talks about how it's becoming popular in mainstream scientific circles to give up that imaginary detached laboratory view and just get into what you're studying and feel like it and be like it. She talks about how my Native American scientist friends said he must integrate with nature to learn from it. But no doubt that's a novel idea to most Western scientists. Still, she says, it happens. She says, I think of Barbara McClintock, Nobel Prize winner in biology, identifying with her corn. Jonas Salk learning to think like a virus. Lynn Margulis discovering the intelligence and consciousness of bacteria by thinking like a bacteria. So none of these persons are rebels against conventional science. Nevertheless, they're showing that the yoga of subjectivity or participation, acquiring knowledge by participating in the web of interconnected relations, this is seeping in to mainstream knowledge methods. So Barbara McClintock won the Nobel Prize in 1983 for studying chromosomes, researching chromosomes, and she said, I observed them from within. She says, I found the more I worked with the chromosomes, the bigger they got. And when I was really working with them from the inside, I was part of their system. I started to think like them. They were my friends. As you look at these things, they become a part of you. So this is a Nobel Prize winner. Now, our usual hero in academic circles is the value-free observer, the unbiased hero who presents nature to us as it is. There's no such thing as nature to us as it is. As Werner Heisenberg said, what we call the study of nature is simply the study of nature as revealed to our particular method of questioning. That's subjectivity. Einstein said that the world of ideas is just as related to our experience as clothes are related to the human form. You can't delete yourself from what you're studying. You can't erase yourself from the world and then think you're getting some objective, pure experience. The ancient yoga texts of India understand that. And so instead of running away from subjectivity, running away from accepting your participation, they hit the nail right on the head. Since you are a subjective conscious entity, learn how to purify and transform your consciousness so that your experience of the world will change. And indeed, you'll become conscious of things that are beyond the limits of normal knowledge. What's seen to be normal by mainstream knowledge, you'll go beyond that because your consciousness has been enhanced. That is the purpose of the yoga system. The whole point of the physical asanas, training the body for toning and flexibility, is to still the mind. The whole point of the breathing exercises, pranayama, is to make the mind quiet. So then, with a quieted mind, you can focus on the ultimate goal of life. You can see through the world of matter and perceive the consciousness that is in everyone. Once we add consciousness back into the picture, things start to come alive for us. As long as you try to understand a world without consciousness, how can you come up with satisfying knowledge? And you're seeing more and more the results of societies that have failed in consciousness technology. They can't even manage to live in their own habitat without destroying it. This is quite embarrassing. Human beings, the only creatures that destroy their own habitat in the name of advancement and progress. This predicament comes from a failure to understand what is consciousness, how to transform consciousness. The spiritual ecologist, the spiritual environmentalist, understands that you may clean the air, you may clean the water, you may clean up the food, but as long as the consciousness is impure, the same environmental pollution will happen again. So the yoga system, particularly the bhakti yoga system, focuses upon transforming the consciousness, and then your life becomes transformed, your connectivity to others becomes transformed, and ultimately, of course, you're dealing with the supreme consciousness. So, analyze. Why do I have this faith that matter is the all in all? Why do I accept that version of reality? It's indeed a religious principle. What we're proposing is that science, as commonly known, is a legitimate way of getting knowledge, and the ancient yoga systems, especially bhakti yoga, known contemporarily as Krishna consciousness, this is also a system for acquiring knowledge. So what we have to do is decide, what is the best kind of knowledge for me to get? Technology has its purpose, it provides its conveniences, it causes a lot of havoc also. Knowledge of the self, enlightenment, has its place in the scheme of things. So just because we talk about enlightenment, knowledge of consciousness, knowledge of the supreme consciousness, does that automatically mean, oh, faith, religious superstition? Not at all. If techniques are being presented for verifying the spiritual reality. This is why I like what Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, because the techniques are given how to verify all the non-material presentations of reality. This is what attracted me in my studies of Bhagavad Gita upon finishing my university studies. In so many chapters in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, all right, here is a principle. This is how things are. And then Krishna gives you the techniques to verify that. So I thought, this is very fair, because I just don't want to be a true believer. I want to experience. I think if we'll look at ordinary science and spiritual science in that way, a lot of misperceptions, misunderstandings can be cleared. If those of you here who may be studying science, let me read you the words of one of the grand patriarchs of modern quantum mechanics, Niels Bohr. This was his conclusion. We can admittedly find nothing in physics or chemistry that has even a remote bearing on consciousness. Yet all of us know that there is such a thing as consciousness simply because we have it ourselves. Hence, consciousness must be part of nature, or, more generally, of reality, which means that, quite apart from the laws of physics and chemistry as laid down in quantum theory, we must also consider laws of quite a different kind. So he's willing to be open. And that's all we're asking. That let us be open and entertained that there could be laws of nature that govern consciousness in a non-material way. And let's see if there are techniques for entering that reality, laboratory practices for verifying that reality. When you talk about the laws of nature, as scientists currently present it, you're indeed dealing with faith. Where do the laws come from? Why are there laws? The common response to that question will be, this is not a scientific question. Where do the laws of nature come from? Why are there laws? It's just the way things are. And you just accept that because that's the way things are. This is faith. Or you look at the Big Bang. There's no point in asking where or when the Big Bang occurred, because there was no time for the Big Bang to occur in, and there was no space for it to occur in. So you can't say where or when. And where did whatever exploded come from? You can't talk about that either. So even in ordinary science, there are certain things you have to accept that are just, well, they're beyond our current perception. You'll find the same thing in spiritual science. I would say there's a difference, though. In the spiritual science, in the ancient yoga texts, we're talking particularly about the bhakti texts, or the Krishna texts, you are given techniques which can enter into the most subtle realities if you're willing to become transformed. In other words, there's a price to pay. You have to refine your consciousness, distill your consciousness. Not everyone wants to pay that price. I was talking to one professor of quantum mechanics at Harvard University. He told me, he said, you know, he said, you Krishna people, you may think you're quite rigorous and you have to go through a lot of training and distilling and refining to get to the point where you can, you know, enter into the realm of Krishna consciousness. Well, let me tell you what we put our physics students through in order to enter the mystical world of quantum mechanics. He said it takes on the average 8 years to readjust their minds so that they can start thinking in a suitable way to grasp the strange world of quantum mechanics. He says it takes 8 years because the quantum reality is so contrary to what your senses ordinarily perceive. So it takes 8 years for us to get students to think the right way. Now, obviously, if it takes 8 years just to understand a material reality, what's wrong with putting in a little time and effort and transformation for understanding spiritual science? So, as long as methods of verification are presented, we should not be afraid of spiritual science. The yoga of participation, subjectivity. Let's be honest and admit, since the first grade in school, we have been going through the yoga of objectivity, honing the mind in a certain way, adjusting the mind to view the world in a certain way, and you get graded on that, and you're tested, and there's social conditioning, peer pressure, and gradually by the time you're at the university, you know, your mind is focused a certain way. All right, that has some limited success. We're not criticizing that. What we're trying to point out today is the yoga of objectivity, and actually it's not objective because there are hidden assumptions that everything is matter, that anything that's real can be quantified. They're hidden assumptions. Okay, take that system as far as it goes, but at the same time recognize there's value in the yoga of subjectivity, of participation. Subjectivity is not a bad word. It's not a dirty word. As a conscious being, you are subjective. So the question is, rather than run from it or artificially deny it, why not come out of the closet and start thinking how to purify it? That is the thrust of the bhakti system. You're a conscious entity, just like Bhagavad Gita explains. Just like the sun illuminates the whole universe. Similarly, the non-material entity in the body illuminates the whole body with consciousness. So, okay, you say, how can I verify that? How can I indeed perceive that I have a non-material identity and there's a supreme non-material identity and a relationship between the two? Should I just believe? Now, of course, just to enter the laboratory, it takes some good faith that this could be a worthwhile experiment. Even if you're investigating material science, you have to have some hunch that it's going to be worthwhile for me to investigate this phenomenon. But then you expect to find a laboratory experience. Similarly, in bhakti yoga, in Krishna consciousness, the same is there. It takes a little faith just to get your foot in the door. Yeah, I think this could be worthwhile. But then, there are laboratory techniques for verifying the spiritual reality. There'll be step-by-step confirmation. Now, of course, the goals get very high, but there's always laboratory techniques to reach those high goals. And one thing that you'll immediately notice if you seriously take up the bhakti path according to the precepts and techniques described in the yoga texts, you'll notice that your sense perception changes. And your ability to understand changes simply because of purifying your consciousness. In other words, the yoga texts recognize a complete connection between your personal behavior and what you can understand. This is alien to the Western system of knowledge. The Western system of knowledge upholds that my personal behavior has got nothing to do with how much I can understand about the world, about the universe. All right, let's just take Stephen Hawking, for example. Paralyzed to such an extent he can't speak, and his wife took care of him dutifully for so many years. And then he had some children before he was paralyzed, and so they were all looking after him very nicely. And then Stephen Hawking, in his own words, decided, you know, I wanted to see what it was like to have an affair. I wanted to see if I could do it. So he struck up an affair with his nurse and disrupted his whole family. And even his daughter was, shall we say, grossed out. He told me that he just did it just to show that, you know, he could pull it off. Now, according to the precepts of Western knowledge, the yoga of objectivity, what his personal behavior has nothing to do with his ability to understand the cosmos. But the yoga of participation, the yoga of subjectivity, as presented in the yoga texts, will say, your personal behavior will affect your perception, will affect your ability to understand. Just like clouds can pass over a sun and block, clouds can pass over the sunlight and block the sunlight. In the same way, certain behaviors make it difficult to understand subtle knowledge. So these are some differences between the two types of yogas. Both have their successes, but simply we have to understand what kind of success we want in life. Then we can decide which modality for acquiring knowledge will be the number one priority. So this is my point in conclusion. It's not a question of one or the other. It's a question of priority. You can endeavor in the field of material science, and you can also endeavor in the field of spiritual science. Depending on the state of your consciousness, who you are, your subjectivity, that will determine which one has a higher priority in your life. So please don't be disturbed by the notion that to explore the bhakti science, you're being unscientific, superstitious, mythological. And you can always bring up, in case anyone criticizes you, what about consciousness? Can you please give me a scientific explanation of consciousness? How do I understand consciousness? Where did it come from? Does consciousness suddenly come from matter? Have you ever seen that happen? If you want to really get tricky, I'm not going to get into it now, ask someone, how did consciousness evolve? Ooh. Go to the biology department and ask that question. Try it. I do it all the time. All right. right. I think we'll end right there.